He catches my eye as I'm leaving a subway station in Toronto. Sitting on the side by the entrance is a Native American man panhandling. Now, usually I am an inconsistent donor to panhandlers. In the grand scheme of things, I know that my couple of bucks here or there will probably do little to no good, and maybe, in fact, do some harm. But I do have this guilt, empathy, shame complex that gets triggered in these moments. Maybe you do too. And when he caught my eye and asked for some change, I was about to respond with my typical, "I don't think I have any change on me," before he blurted out, "I've been sober for 5 years. I won't spend your money on alcohol." That's what people think seeing an Indian on the street. They just see a drunk Indian. But I just want some food. My heart winces. The stereotype of the drunk Indian is so pervasive that this man needs to go on the offensive, to get ahead of the story so that he'd bypass the bias to earn a couple of dollars of compassion or guilt from his would-be donors. I gave him all the change I had in my pocket. I didn't care if he was lying to me about being sober or how he would spend the money. My heart was broken that his very life depended on the Sisyphean task of combating a racial cultural stereotype. My friend Gary is a doctor up in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which ranks up there with Parabinabu, Suriname as the funnest place name to say. He and some of his colleagues noticed recently that there was a dramatically disproportionate number of First Nations patients who were dying in the hospital due to sepsis. His investigations revealed that these patients were coming into the emergency rooms with all of the symptoms of sepsis, just they were not being treated. Why? Because the common symptoms of sepsis are confusion, disorientation, agitation, dizziness when standing up, nausea, and vomiting. Symptoms that line up exactly with those of intoxication. The stereotype of the drunk Indian was claiming life after life after life. In no way in Gary's investigation did he find that the medical staff working at the hospital were intentionally racially prejudiced. Simply an ambient unconscious bias within Canada's mental furniture, within the psychosocial structure of our day-to-day reality, nudged them away from the correct diagnosis to a deadly one. Don't hang the antibiotics. It's just another drunk Indian. This is the banal reality of evil. Most of its tendrils cloak themselves in the ordinary, in the unconscious. We are taught to think of evil in this world as being instantly obvious, contained only in the most hatred, the most violent and destructive figures of our time. But that's not where it truly lies. In the thousands of smaller moments and choices that lead towards the coronation of atrocity, that is truly where evil lives. Calvin Coolidge, the notoriously terse 30th president of the United States, supposedly went to church one Sunday without his wife. Upon returning, his wife inquired, "What was the sermon about?" "Evil," said Mr. Coolidge. "But what did the minister say about evil?" his wife retorted. "He was against it." Now, I must concur with whichever Congregationalist minister who must have given a truly memorable sermon that day. Evil, I'm against it. But it begs a greater question. What exactly do we mean by the word evil? In Old English and other older Germanic languages, the word evil is the most comprehensive adjectival expression of disapproval, of dislike, of disparagement. At the heart of questions of the existence and the nature of evil is the human longing to make sense of why harm, violence, destruction, conflict, and pain seem to be the enduring state of affairs in our world. Why? Why is it that we as humans have such a difficult time living in peace? Why do bad things happen to good people? How can some people commit the most heinous acts of violence and be unrepentant? Why, despite what I desire and who I am most of the time, do I hurt other people? Or maybe, if I'm honest, sometimes want to. Religious liberals like ourselves have struggled with the conception of evil. The most common formulations tend to leave us a little bit queasy, if we're honest. Either evil is the result of some otherworldly force, some supernatural power like the devil interfering in our human affairs. I mean, I can count the number of exorcisms I've done in my ministry on one hand. On the other hand, evil is seen as an inherently human characteristic, which challenges our optimism in human potential or our capacity to be and do good. And we have tended thus, caught between these most common formulations, to not focus on the question of evil and whether or not we should define it or even if we think it exists. So many of us default to that Supreme Court justice way of thinking about it, that we know evil when we see it. But I don't think our day and age, I don't think in our time such as now, we can get away with such an underdeveloped conception of evil. The Reverend John Burens, former president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, says that the best statement he knows about the nature of evil is by the 20th century theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. Evil, Niebuhr says, is always the assertion of some self-interest without regard to the whole. Whether the whole be conceived as the immediate community, or the total community of humanity, or the total world order, the good is, on the other hand, always the harmony of the whole on all the various levels. My rough definition that I'll put out here today for evil: evil is any action that forecloses on the realization of universal human flourishing. Poverty is evil. Racism is evil. War is evil. Hatred, atrocity, autocracy, shame. They're all evil. They all foreclose on the potential for a human and humans in community to flourish. Now, not all evil is done by humans, mind you. I went to a Roman Catholic seminary for undergrad, so whenever I'm writing these things, I have my Roman Catholic teachers up here telling me all the things about evil. And in Roman Catholic thought, there's a whole category that they call non-moral evils. Which is a bit counterintuitive, but I think it's actually really helpful. These non-moral evils are worldly forces like disease or natural disasters that by themselves would prevent human flourishing, but occur not because of human malice. And so when I think about the devastation of an earthquake, I think about an evil being committed not by on our hands, but just by the nature of its destructive power. Now, Catholic theology also insists that true evil is done with intention, that an action can have evil effects, but without the intention to break God's law or moral law, the action itself isn't evil. I'm not so sure about that. We all know what the road to hell is paved with, in fact. Instead, I think the most important dividing line is between those who consider evil as the embodiment of an ontological state or a state of being, or considering it the category of evil as being adjectival, a description of behavior that is consciously or even unwittingly employed. Whether evil is a state of being, if you as a person, if people can be evil, or if simply our actions can be. Now, if we indeed all do go together, if our universalist faith calls us to see the power of love, I think our universalist faith calls us to see evil not as a state of being, but as actions that any of us are susceptible to take, that people are never evil, even though our actions may be. But I think that is a statement of faith, because from within it we see the gleam of the possibility of transformation and healing that the power of love and resistance can ply on any human soul. I don't think we can find proof of that. In fact, when we wrestle with questions of evil, it is often the most heinous people that we call to mind to see if we can somehow think that they wouldn't be all totally 100% evil. I don't think I can convince you of the fact either way. What I can say is that our faith and our universalist ancestors have said the way we live, that if we live into a way that sees behaviors as evil, then maybe our hearts won't be hardened, and maybe we can push through and transform a person through our love of them, through the love of the good that could be born through them. Universalists like Orestes Bronson, another great name, Clarence Skinner, and members of the social gospel movement in the late 19th century preached that evil was not a state of the human heart, but rather the result of what they called social sins. That the very structures of society, societal attitudes, behaviors, laws, or practice foreclosed intentionally or unintentionally on human flourishing, and casts us all as actors in the ongoing carnage. The racial stereotype of the drunk Indian embodies a structure of evil that leads to extermination, denigration, and death. That evil, far from being simply being a behavior of an individual, is in fact embedded in our society. A few years ago, I found myself driving into the Palestinian West Bank from Jerusalem. Now, passing from Israel into the Palestinian territory felt rather uneventful, as if we were going through some toll on the interstate. The highway opened up in front of us, and the desert and its rolling hills with its patches of shrubs and those beautiful twisted trunks of olive trees sprung up as we sped down the highway. My attention was rapt. But every so often, the view was cut off with seemingly random sections of concrete wall that appeared out of nowhere. They started and stopped abruptly. You could easily walk around the sections, so their utility and defense seemed minimal to me. So I looked up and inquired about this from our tour guide, a young Israeli recently released from prison after refusing to serve in the army. "What are those walls for?" I inquired. Now, we were driving on an Israeli-only road that connect Israel to the dozens of illegal settlements, illegal colonies of Israelis living within the land that should be Palestinians. The barriers built along the highway were built so that the settlers don't have to see the Palestinians, the villages that dotted the landscape. She pulls out a map, and she shows me the tiny dots marking the villages, and each one we pass is obscured. Before my trip to Israel, I always wondered how those who lived in the settlements, decried from the United Nations and the majority of the world as illegal and immoral, lived with themselves. They must be fanatics, I thought. How could they leave work, drive home, passing the homes of the people whose land they stole? Wouldn't that daily reminder prick themselves and become too much to bear? But in that moment, I got it. They didn't have to see it. They didn't have to see it. From driving from Jerusalem to a settlement in the West Bank had the exact same emotional tenor as driving into the suburbs. Our guide pauses for a second and says, "And you know, the government incentivizes living in the settlements. Most of the people who live here don't do it for religious reasons. They do it because they're poor. They do it because the government gives them money. They can save a lot by living here." An evil that I thought was personal, that was about a person, was broken open. And I saw the structures that lifted up and made that choice, which I thought was so reprehensible, understandable, and easy. This is the infrastructure of evil, embodied in concrete, rebar, and cash. The structures, physical and social, that hide and obscure from sight the tearing of the fabric of our interdependence. The structures of evil that make it easy, understandable, and mindless to do harm rather than to serve justice. I don't know about you, but for the last 5 years, I think I've spent at least 2 days every year watching TED Talks. One of my favorite TED Talks is about a bridge in London. And not that bridge, another bridge. See, they built this beautiful new bridge that was going to go over the River Thames. It looks like kind of a sheet of light at night because it's backlit. It looks kind of like a lightsaber, actually, which is part of the reason I like it. But the bridge was only open for 1 day. They opened the bridge, and there was, of course, a big fanfare. I'm sure there were giant scissors that were used to cut some sort of ribbon, and they thus unleashed all the people to go walk on the bridge. Now, the engineers, of course, had done their due diligence. They had tried to figure out how they could withstand so many people standing on the bridge, and they figured that, yes, this was a structurally stable bridge. But as the hordes of people released onto this new bridge set out across the river, the bridge began to sway back and forth, back and forth. And so immediately they shut it down. It seemed not only nauseating, but potentially dangerous. And so, of course, they brought in all the finest minds to figure out what was going on. Why was this bridge swaying meters to the side? What they found was that they had created the bridge so that it could move a few inches back and forth. That was one of the ways that they could reduce the stress in its suspension. But what they hadn't counted on was that as 1, 2, 10, 100 people walked out onto the bridge, they would feel this subtle sway, and they would adjust their gait just a little bit. And so as it grew, the adjustments started to become not just an inch on either side, but a meter, and it became dangerous. I think that has a lot to tell us about how evil operates in our world. Each of us has within us the capacity and even the tendency to prevent human flourishing, ourselves and others. It's just there. We don't always want to talk about it, but it's there. And while an individual acting on these tendencies can do much harm, And the origin of that desire, I'm not going to get into. Maybe Gretchen will do that one. It is when that tendency within us is synchronized into a structure of being that we truly experience the full and true meaning of the word evil. When we magnify that tendency towards breaking off of relationship, of demonizing a person or a people's, and we build that into the way of being, when we make it easy for people to do it, that is when we see true evil coming forth. So while the exorcism of evil from our world includes the transformation of our individual hearts, the most powerful exorcism of evil has to happen at this bigger level. Our fight against evil is not to vanquish those who have become the tools, as we all have from time to time, of its ploys, but instead to become ancestors to a legacy of grace. That our goal in combating the structures of evil that would divide us from each other is to leave for our children not a perfect society, for the burden on our hearts would be too much to contemplate any realm of perfection, but simply to leave for them a society in which maybe, just maybe, they will have an easier time choosing good. That the nudges of our society will nudge us towards choosing justice and connection rather than disconnection and hate. That maybe we have to transform the infrastructure of our interdependence towards goodness. That the mental furniture of our nation should not, nor should it ever be, America first, but one of dignity and compassion for all. Maybe we need to change up our ways of being to see patriotism not used to divide us from our kindred around the world, but instead inviting us to honor our distinctiveness with equity. Transforming our ambient culture with every conversation, we can do this. With each refusal to cooperate, with each planned movement of advocacy, with every tweet, and indeed, every pussy hat donned. We are, in fact, helping each other, reminding each other, and nudging each other towards the light. Chris Hedges writes, "A democratic state begins from the assumption that most of those who gravitate towards power are mediocre and probably immoral. It assumes that we must always protect ourselves from bad government. We must be prepared for the worst leaders, even as we hope for the best." As Karl Popper wrote, this understanding leads to a new approach to power. It forces us to replace the question, who shall rule, by the question, how can we organize political institutions so that bad or incompetent leaders can be prevented from doing too much damage? And more aptly, for all of us, how can we arrange our lives so we can do the same? Our resistance towards the structures of evil, not reduced to people who perpetrate it, allows the transformation we demand to be about something much greater than who is in power, but rather it becomes an enduring commitment to continual liberation. May we never forget the power we can unleash together. Amen, and blessed be.